From CJLO 1690 AM in Montreal, Quebec, I'm your host, Daniel Lasoski, and this again, my friends, is Liberty in Exile.
And so it is to the recorder of man's deeds, the keeper of his conscience, the courier of his news, that we look for strength and assistance, confident that with your help, man will be what he was born to be, free and independent.
We do not choose to be ruled. We elect to be governed.
In your heart, you know he's right.
Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. I come to bring you liberty, not destroy it. Evil that governments do lives after them. The good is often turned with their bones. So let it be with liberty in exile. Hello and welcome to the program. I'm your host, Daniel Lasoski, reporting to you from the bustling metropolis that is Montreal, Quebec, in Gitmo Nation, Great White North, on this the 10th day of December 2010. Our website, as always, is libertyinexile.com. That is libertyinexile.com. There you'll find the show blog, the Twitter feed, the links, the feeds, the videos, the podcast, and much more offered to you free of charge. Also, do check out our iTunes podcast in the iTunes store. And let us delve into the issues of the day. I do welcome you once again. Let's look at our subjects that we have lined up on the queue. We have Claim the Interwebs, Tax Cut Frenzy, WikiPeaks, Terror Theater, Climate Disruption Function, Police State, We Mad, The Science Lifts Off, Drug War, I Hate You, Hollywood Hitman, and The Nanny State. Wow, we have plenty of information here for this Friday broadcast, going from A to Z. So much to cover. Let's see. Number one thing that is dominating the airways and has been for a long time now is the WikiLeaks saga, which I've labeled WikiPeaks. Now, as I was saying on Carl Knox's show just a few minutes ago, and for those of you that will be available as a podcast on libertyinexile.com as well as through the podcast feed, I was talking about what I saw of WikiLeaks and how I, at first, looked at the information, digested it, sort of analyzed it, and came not really to idolize WikiLeaks like a lot of different people have. I think it's quite suspicious that an organization comes out of absolutely nowhere, and all of a sudden you have an army of hackers and loyalists and everyone defending it when we really don't know that much about it. And most of the information that has been put out, these are things that we've covered on this show for the past year now. These are things that people who are in tune to this show and are in tune to alternative media have known about for a long time. Therefore, it was not surprising for a lot of this information to come out. But a lot of the debate does come around to talk about Julian Assange himself, WikiLeaks as a journalistic entity, and the consequences of that. And there are a lot of people who are upset and, of course, have taken to the airwaves, and the talking heads have gone rampant. And, of course, this upsetted people on the internet. People on the internet were very upset. And I think they did this way too precariously. They did it way too quickly. And they basically attacked, that's right, attacked the services that took, basically cut off their contracts with WikiLeaks. Here we are.
The website of credit card company MasterCard was disrupted by supporters of arrested WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, according to claims via a feed on Twitter. And Visa's website was affected later in the day. The cyberstrikes were believed to be in retaliation after both blocked payments to WikiLeaks following a series of embarrassing leaks involving the U.S.
Okay, so that's what we've had now from different media organizations and the interwebs and those websites that are of hackerish tendency, of which I do know. Now, these people basically thought they'd be the sort of the vengeance, the vigilantes of the internet, and go and try to take down the website of Visa and MasterCard, even though that does absolutely nothing. It's just a publicity stunt. Really didn't do much, I don't think. But, I mean, there are different things that did come out in the WikiLeaks stories the past few weeks. Now, if you do check out our show notes at libertyinexile.com, you'll see the number of stories that I have and the different angles that they are taking. And hackers, of course, have taken to the internet. They've supported it. And it just seems odd to me. Very, very odd. Julian Assange walks into London Police Department, turns himself in knowingly, and he'll definitely be in prison at least for the next 2 weeks. No bail, no chance. I'm just not sure about this. And there are a lot of people, especially in the alternative media, who are quite suspicious of WikiLeaks, even though the information is quite good. I would say these are true diplomatic cables. There's nothing entirely revealing. There's nothing that says that the government lied to bring us to Iraq and to stay in Afghanistan, and there's a constant PR push to keep our troops there and to build a permanent base. There's no mention of that at all in the cables, so that doesn't surprise me. I'm not looking for anything like that of the sort. But there are different points that come up about journalistic integrity, about who is a journalist. And there are different senators and congressmen that have come out and they want to define what journalist means. They want to define what publisher means. Who controls the information? Well, it should be us, of course. And there's an entire bill that was created in the Senate. This is coming from the Hill. Senators unveil anti-WikiLeaks bill. So Senators John Ensign, Joe Lieberman, and Scott Brown introduced a bill Thursday aimed at stopping WikiLeaks by making it illegal to publish the names of military or intelligence community informants. Now, that is already entrenched in law, but of course this is reactionary legislation, as is always passed by those slowpokes in the Senate and the Congress. Ensign accused WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange and his cronies of hindering America's war efforts and creating a hit list for U.S. enemies by outing intelligence sources. A hit list for U.S. enemies. Interestingly enough, our sources are bravely risking their lives when they stand up against the tyranny of Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, and murderous regimes, and I simply will not stand idly by as they become death targets because of Julian Assange, Ensign said. Let me be very clear. WikiLeaks is not a whistleblower website, and Assange is not a journalist. So that's what's come out of our own American government now. And that is John Ensign, who, of course, I do not trust. And hopefully he will not have any sort of Republican leadership, because this guy is... But he's going off on one end. And when they come up and say that, and they give a label to an organization, say, well, you are not a journalist entity, you are not a whistleblower website, you are not a journalist. Whenever they make a distinction like that, they favor one group over another, which is exactly what the First Amendment provides against. It says that you shall make absolutely no law infringing upon the freedom of the press. No law. No law. And what they're trying to do with this law is go against the First Amendment. There we are. It all comes down to information, and it comes down to information and the interwebs. It comes down to the internet. It comes down to language that is used. It comes out to information that is put out across this great place that we call the internet, the freest forum that we know of our age right now. It exists right there. And what I see that these attacks on WikiLeaks and the entire existence of WikiLeaks in the media and the prevalence of it is that it is being used to control the information that we have on the internet. Now, number one, case in point, is what Hillary Clinton just said months ago. Months ago. Now, you had Hillary Clinton, who many, many years ago, many months ago, many weeks ago, from the very beginning, has always been for internet freedom. We have to keep the internet free. We have to make sure that it's okay. It stays away from, you know, politicians and all. And then she goes on Fox News just the other day and has a very different message.
I will not comment on or confirm what are alleged to be stolen State Department cables. But I can say that the United States deeply regrets the disclosure of any information that was intended to be confidential, including private discussions between counterparts or our diplomats' personal assessment.
Now, she's reading from a statement here, very serious, stern, pissed off. This is Hillary Clinton.
Assessments and observations. I want to make clear that our official foreign policy is not set through these messages, but here in Washington. Our policy is a matter of public record, as reflected in our statements and our actions around the world. I would also add that to the American people and to our friends and partners, I want you to know that we are taking aggressive steps to hold responsible those who stole this information.
We're going to hold these people responsible, have huge witch trials.
I have directed that specific actions be taken at the State Department, in addition to new security safeguards at the Department of Defense and elsewhere, to protect State Department information so that this kind of breach cannot and does not ever happen again.
So, of course, Hillary is embarrassed, number one, because she was the State Department head who basically ordered ambassadors to try to get DNA information, fingerprints, credit card numbers from other diplomats at the UN. Now, this is Hillary Clinton who said this, and this came out in the WikiLeaks documents. And I have them all linked up, libertyinexile.com. You can make your own decision on that. Very good information, talking about how Russia is basically a mafia state, how Saudi Arabia would love to bomb Iran, how people cannot go and meet with President Obama unless they take prisoners from Guantanamo. That's one of the biggest things that hasn't been mentioned in the media. The specific example is the Slovenian president of Slovenia, who would like to meet with Obama. And they say, yeah, you can meet with Obama. Just take a couple of two or three or four of these terrorists that we got from Guantanamo prison. So there we go. You have to take them if you want to talk. And we're back with much more on Liberty in Exile, CJLO, 1690 AM in Montreal, Quebec. Okay, Liberty in Exile, CJLO, 1690 AM. I got to say, we have a special caller here on the line. Amazingly, I just received this call. I guess he was a fan of my rant, but it seems as if we do have President George W. Bush on the line. I got to say, welcome to the show, dear President. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Well, you're kind to say it, and I appreciate our friendship. I really do. It was a friendship that was forged immediately, and because I think we share the same values in many ways.
Yeah?
And plus, as I told you, I love to laugh, and you're a funny guy.
Well, I got to say, thanks a lot there, President. That means a lot. I didn't know that you were such a fan of Liberty in Exile, but hey, pretty good. We got to take our fans where they come. I guess I have you here on the phones. Might as well ask you a few questions. Of course, we're sort of living in an age now where we're the American Empire, and we're living in an age where we have over 700 military bases around the world. I got to say, a lot of them are thanks to you. And I just got to say, how does it feel knowing that you brought our country basically into wars across the world, and we're spending trillions upon trillions of dollars in killing innocent civilians abroad by use of the American flag? I mean, how does that make you feel, Mr. President?
Yeah, they say, do you miss much in the presidency? And the truth of the matter is, I don't miss much. I do miss being pampered. And one of the ways you're pampered is you never have to sit in a traffic jam.
Okay, so you're not really answering my questions. Okay, we're hanging up on the president. Ah, there we are. Non-repentant, that is the man. But that's enough. We'd like to see what's going on with the drug war. That's one thing that I've covered for a while, and it's sort of gotten extremely bad in Mexico. Extremely bad. As we've covered on this show before, 30,000 individuals have been killed in the last 4 years alone. But where does this stem from? I don't know. This piece actually ran on Fox News the other day. Very interesting. Listen to the tone.
Well, Jenna, you know, it's easy to point fingers and pass judgment on Mexico for the violence in that country. But their war is our war because of the money that 21 million Americans will pay to get their illegal drugs past that fence.
the only way Mexico will regain their security and get away from such lawless behavior is to take the money out of this whole illegal drug market. And it's our money. We should be ashamed of ourselves.
It's Mexico's war, but Americans pay for it.
Anybody that's buying narcotics is financing that effort.
Heroin, methamphetamine, marijuana, and cocaine all originate from or transit through Mexico. The U.S.-Mexican border is but one hurdle for the cartels, one step in a long but profitable journey that fuels the violence in Mexico. Take a single kilo of cocaine. It originates as a coca plant in Peru, Bolivia, or Colombia. Price to the farmer, about $1,000 a kilo. Flown to Colombia, it doubles in price as it's processed into powder. From there, it travels by plane, truck, or submarine to Mexico, where the price jumps to $10,000 a kilo. Now the difficult leg, crossing over or under the U.S. border. Stuffed in cars, smuggled by illegal immigrants, a kilo north of the fence triples in price to $30,000.
Okay, so we hear about what's going on there, and you do have the drug war, and finally people are connecting the dots. They're finally connecting the dots that why the entire violence is going on is not just because Mexico is Mexico. Not at all. It's because of the drug demand here in the United States and Canada. So because drugs are illegal in places such as these, the violence occurs elsewhere, and that is in Mexico, which has become basically a narco state. Now, that's not going to be in the Wiki cables, but it'll be in the Liberty and Exile cables. Truth to be told here, but there we are. Of course, we always have tons of information on this. You can go and check it out. There's a story that I actually never got to last week talking about more police chiefs that have been murdered, killed, beheaded. The danger is real, and the danger is something that we need to be aware of, and we have to understand what our part is in it, and we have to accept responsibility. And that isn't to say that, well, what we should do is just kill all drug dealers. Not at all. It has to do with looking at the drug policy, looking at the politics of it, because that's what it is. Whenever you try to control something centrally, it is doomed to fail. But let us transition into tax policy. I call this tax cut frenzy, and we had basically the new tax deal that came out, and it upset people on the left, the proverbial left, that is, progressives that are supposed to be of the Democratic wing. And they were upset because this was a tax deal that, as they say and as they frame it, this was just a proposal that was tax cuts for the rich. Now, whenever George Bush signed these tax cuts, this is starting back in 2001, 2003, whenever he first signed these, this was a tax cut for every single person in the United States. Now, why they say they're tax cuts for the rich is because, well, the rich at that time were paying the highest taxes, and they removed that, and there we are, they got a tax cut. But so did everybody else. So this year, that is set to expire in December 2010. It is set to expire, and taxes will go back to the previous rates during the Clinton administration. That's the entire point. So when they say this is just the tax cuts for the rich, they're extremely wrong. If they don't vote this in, then taxes will go up on every single American in the United States. That's how it works. But of course, the rhetoric and how it's framed is that, well, these are tax cuts for the rich. And what does that create? It creates more class warfare. You create a society where being prosperous and being successful is a terrible, bad thing, and you are vilified. Vilified. And that's exactly what happens in times of recession. The same thing that happens in times of protectionism is that we vilify those who have been successful when we have not been. Now, that isn't to say that most of these people who are in the upper echelons are not responsible. Believe me, they're the ones who are gambling away with the billions of dollars, but the government was the one who gave them the trillions. 9.9 trillion, it came out this week, that the Federal Reserve lent out to all of these institutions without accountability. Now, this is an unelected branch of the executive. Federal Reserve right there, a private central bank lending away $9 trillion. But this does upset people, and all it is doing is creating this class warfare dogma. This is something that Marx talked about in Communist Manifesto, and it is basically a huge mantra for those who have progressive ideas. They honestly do see society as entirely separated between haves and have-nots, between the rich and the poor. There's a 100% line distinction, and they are mad about that. And they're extremely upset at Obama because Obama compromised. Now, this tax deal, as far as I see it, is pretty bad. It's pretty stupid once you go back and actually look at the numbers, whereas it's not going to really save any money anywhere. So all they're doing is permanently re-extending those tax cuts for 2 years, and at the same time, coupled in the same bill, they're going to re-extend unemployment benefits for 18 months. Unemployment benefits is just another name for welfare, so basically they're just going to extend welfare for another year and a half and include these tax cuts. So basically you just have $600 billion more of a deficit, so you're not really doing anything in terms of cutting this deficit that we have. And the deficit last year was $1 trillion. Keep that in mind. $1 trillion. $1 trillion. Of course, really the only way, and most of the money that basically is collected by Congress goes to agricultural subsidies, war, Social Security, and Medicare. These are the three places that it really goes. And until the leaders in Washington come out with plans to cut these, I hate to say it, my friends, but there isn't going to be no change in Washington. But Obama is quite angry, and he has been upset. Let's listen here as he responds to his critics upon the podium. This is the Obama that I like.
Success or core principles? Then let's face it, we will never get anything done. People will have the satisfaction of having a purist position and no victories for the American people. And we will be able to feel good about ourselves and sanctimonious about how pure our intentions are and how tough we are.
Now, this is Obama coming out and basically being realistic about when you are president and we have to manage the House and the Senate with basically people from both sides. And he's realizing that he's gonna have to compromise somewhat. Now, I don't agree 100% with this because he does control both houses right now, overwhelmingly. Oh, he has all the control. He does, and he has a majority, and he can push through whatever he may. And a lot of people have made this point in the media saying that he has the control. Do it. But Obama is a compromiser. That is his own route, and that's what he shall take. But, of course, the purist, as he is referring to, who are the ideologues, are basically very upset with him on this. Let us continue here. He gets kind of angry on this. That's why I love listening to this clip.
And in the meantime, the American people are still seeing themselves not able to get health insurance because of pre-existing condition. Or not being able to pay their bills because their unemployment insurance ran out. That can't be the measure of how we think about our public service. That can't be the measure of what it means to be a Democrat. This is a big, diverse country. Not everybody agrees with us. I know that shocks people. Now, the New York Times editorial page does not permeate across all of America. Neither does the Wall Street Journal editorial page. Most Americans, they're just trying to figure out how to go about their lives and how can we make sure that our elected officials are looking out for us. And that means because it's a big, diverse country and people have a lot of complicated positions, it means that in order to get stuff done, we're going to compromise.
That's a great point. Great point by Obama. And it's true. When you're managing a country that has over 320 million people of all types of backgrounds and ideological bents, somewhere you have to meet in the middle, of course. That's what he was saying, and he's realized that as president. If he is a hardliner, which a lot of people say he should have been, maybe he wouldn't have as much support. We can't really tell because that is not the route that he took. Of course, this is the route that Bush took. Plenty of power. Basically usurped all power from the legislature. And what did he do? He created the most powerful executive position known to the American presidency in all time. And Obama hasn't seized upon it. Now, why that is, that I can't say, but he's upset. And, of course, the Democrats are mad, and you especially have people in the media, and these are the worst ones. These are the people who are supposed to give you the news, supposed to be objective, and they go off and they're questioning Axelrod. I believe the first clip is going to be Meredith Vieira.
As we just heard from the president, he has said in that news conference yesterday that he is itching for a fight with the Republicans at a later date. But as you know, many Democrats believe that, you know, that's too late. They're furious about what's happened. They say this is not a compromise, this deal. It is the president caving in. One senator went so far as to call it borderline immoral. So how does he win back these fellow Democrats that he's referred to as sanctimonious?
So these fellow Democrats, such as, this anchor here on CBS, how does he come back and speak to us?
He said that he's doing this for the good of the American people, but by some estimates, this deal, this tax cut deal, could add another $900 billion to a deficit that is already out of control. So why shouldn't the Americans look at this as a disaster in the making?
These people are totally, totally bent. Now, they used to say that the media was in the tank for Obama, but we see the ideological bent. And here we go to George Stephanopoulos, former Clinton staffer and political hack job.
A lot of unhappy Democrats in the House right now.
That means me. Me. I'm very unhappy.
Speaker Nancy Pelosi has not committed to trying to pass this deal. Can you pass it over the opposition of the Speaker of the House? And if Democrats aren't going to sign on? House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said this is a bridge too far. It ends any kind of symmetry between the two sides. Is the White House open to renegotiating this part of the deal? So is this deal set in stone? No wiggle room at all? No more adjustments as it works its way through the House and the Senate?
There's no wiggle room here at all. There's no any type of compromise we can kind of do. I mean, you sure? Oh, Stephanopoulos. He did work for the Clinton White House. Of course, that must be said before all is known, and that is the tax cut frenzy. And there's a lot of economic misnomers that go on here and a lot of misinformation. Once again, I played the clip last week of Nancy Pelosi talking about tax cuts and tax cuts versus unemployment benefits. Basically, she was making the case that unemployment benefits, welfare, they do more to stimulate the economy than tax cuts at all, which is a fallacy, which is totally wrong. All you have to do is read Economics in One Lesson by Henry Hazlitt. All you have to do is read any true economist. There's a lot of progressive economists who are coming out lately and saying, well, this is a good deal. They can go out and people who are on welfare, they can go out to the Dollarama and get more things. I mean, the fact that they're extending the unemployment benefits is not necessarily morally a bad thing, but it won't be stimulating the economy. All you're doing is staving off what's going on. On the last show I talked about with Carl, he was talking about the boom of the Clinton years and how tax rates were so high and there's prosperity everywhere and going on. This is a fallacy that is pushed by those who love taxes. I'll tell you number one why. All you have to do is read the book Maestro by Bob Woodward. He talks about this number one, Alan Greenspan and the Federal Reserve. Now, people don't talk about the Federal Reserve as much as they should. They don't realize that these people print your money. They make your money worthless. Since the Federal Reserve was created in 1913 and started its operation in 1914, the value of the American dollar has dropped 97%. The dollar is 97% less than what it used to be back in 1913. That's what's been created by this. But connecting it to today and to the tax argument and frenzy that is going on, those who argue about the Clinton years, now there was so much prosperity and 22 million jobs were created. You had Alan Grayson, who's the Florida congressman, one of the most progressive members, going onto the floor and saying, well, with these Clinton tax cuts, we had 22 million jobs created. Going off on this point, but what they don't understand is that the boom that was created and why there were so many jobs is because the Federal Reserve lowered their funds rate to record lows. They created this huge boom, and this boom meant loose capital everywhere. Loose capital could be invested here or there. Companies had way more money to invest it here or there. You had a stable tax system at that time. You had no uncertainty at that time. Tax rates were the same, and that's how they were, and that's how they stayed. And then, of course, what else did you have? The Federal Reserve printing billions of dollars. Printing the billions of dollars that they used, of course, to pump. And when you had Alan Greenspan and the Federal Reserve putting all this loose money into the system, it did create a boom. But inevitably, of course, as the rules of economic dictate, it must create a bust. And when did that come? It was supposed to come in 2001. That was the first recession when, of course, President Bush, our loyal caller beforehand, did say that we had to go out and spend our cash. Go out and spend money. Go shopping. That was what we had to do. That was the fun time. Go out and shop. And he staved it off once again. And the Federal Reserve printed more money. And then finally, the bust came in 2008. So we are paying for exactly what happened in those years of Bill Clinton and those high tax rates, as they say. Therefore, we have debunked the idea that the prosperity that occurred during the Clinton years was because taxes were high. What a stupid argument to make. Now, that's just one point. Tax frenzy was talked about a great deal, upset a lot of people, and it upset some Democrats so much that they actually went about to, yell an obscenity at the president.
This has been an extraordinary week in this debate between these two parts of the Democratic Party. But this quote, F the president, kind of strong. What can you tell us about the Democratic revolt in the House this morning?
Well, like Barney Frank, I wasn't there either, yeah. But I did talk to a lot of people who were, and it was pretty startling. There was sotto voce, apparently, you know, not too loud, and F the president. There was a no effing way. He F'd it up. You know, we had a fairly liberal use of the F word inside those closed doors. And there was a lot of anger. And frankly, the president's appearance before this same group of people yesterday, when he tried to explain his side of things, didn't help. As a matter of fact, it just made things worse, is my understanding of it. One member I talked to said, if this is the way he's going to negotiate with the Republicans, what's he going to do with the Iranians, you know? And we had other people telling, I had other people telling me, look, there are 63 members in there, I think it's 63, who lost, who are kind of like the walking ghosts at this point. They're stuck in little cubicles in the basement of the Capitol.
There we go. Okay, so that's what we told. Apparently, during some sort of meeting, someone came out and said, F the president. Now, is that worse than saying, you lie, Joe Wilson, of course, at the State of Union speech? I don't know. Of course, this is it's gone kind of overboard. And you do have the purists and those who are ideologically pure that, of course, are saying that Obama took a bad deal. And that's their own view. And they're allowed to have that. This is a free democratic society, and that's how it works. But transitioning away from these millions and millions of tax cuts that are apparently going off and breaking everything, we got to sort of stay within the realm of monetary policy. And one thing that I'd like to cover, of course, is Ben Bernanke's interview on 60 Minutes, in which he talked about the gap between the rich and the poor. He had an interview with Scott Pelley, and this is Pelley. The gap between the rich and poor in this country has never been greater. In fact, we have the biggest income disparity gap of any industrialized country in the world, and I wonder where you think that's taking America. And then Bernanke responds, it's a very bad development. It's creating two societies. It's based very much, I think, on educational differences. The unemployment rate we've been talking about. If you're a college graduate, unemployment is 5%. If you're a high school graduate, it's a 10% or more. It's a very big difference. It leads to an unequal society and a society which doesn't have the cohesion we'd like to see. Yeah, that's a pretty interesting point from Bernanke that he's talking about here, and he's realizing that as the elite central banker of the world, who is probably the most powerful man, he has a lot to say, and his words do turn out to have a lot of power. But there's an article as well that was covered heavily, Government Can't Print Money Properly. This is from Yahoo News and Associated Press. As a metaphor for our troubled economic and financial era and the government's stumbling response, this one's hard to beat. You can't stimulate the economy via the money supply, after all, if you can't print the money correctly. Because of a problem with the presses, the federal government has shut down production of its flashy new $100 bills and has quarantined more than 1 billion of them, more than 10% of all existing U.S. cash, in a vault in Fort Worth, Texas. There is something drastically wrong here, one source told CNBC. The frustration level is off the charts. Officials with the Treasury and Federal Reserve had touted the new bill's sophisticated security features that were 10 years in the making, including a 3D security strip and a color-shifting image of a bell designed to foil counterfeiters. counterfeiters. But it turns out the bills are so high-tech that the presses can't handle the printing job. More than 1 billion unusable bills have been printed. Some of the bills creased during production, and they created a blank space on the paper, one official told CNBC. So here's the news, guys. News flash coming in. Money that doesn't exist, and the government can't print it correctly. So this is paper money that's cost about 20 cents basically to print a $100 bill, and they're screwing up the printing of it. So money that doesn't actually mean anything, that is actually worthless, not backed by gold or any commodity, and only exists because you accept its reality, it's basically having to be scrapped once more, and these security features, and against these counterfeiters that are messing everything up. Oh my goodness. Okay, enough about money. This is CJLO 1690 AM, Montreal, Quebec, Liberty in Exile, and we do have other subjects that we do like to tackle, and we do state that we are the alternative media, and there are stories that we will cover that others will not cover. There are slants that we take that, of course, others shan't. And this is coming, of course, from the news as well. This came down the wire. Another case. Here it comes.
Another case of suspected homegrown terror. Another U.S. citizen plotting to blow up Americans. Today, it was 21-year-old Antonio Martinez, a.k.a. Mohammed Hussein, a recent convert to Islam, arrested by federal agents this morning after attempting to detonate a car bomb outside this Armed Forces Recruiting Center in Maryland. The bomb was fake, supplied to him by FBI undercover agents.
Oh, there's the point once more. Supplied to him by FBI undercover agents. Again, another patsy, another instance of when the FBI is basically taking some stupid troubled kid and pushing him into trying to blow something up.
Because the FBI was controlling the weapons that were used, there was no actual danger to the public as a result of the operation this morning.
Yeah, because the weapons actually came from the government, the public was never actually in danger. It was, him on his own.
In court papers, the government charged Martinez, a married construction worker, with attempted murder of federal officers and employees, and attempted use of a weapon of mass destruction.
A weapon of mass destruction, of which the government did provide.
According to this affidavit, the government was tipped to Martinez back in October, recording numerous conversations he allegedly had with an informant, as well as an undercover agent over 2 months. In one, Martinez said, "We blow one recruiting center up, then we hit another one. There's no more recruiting centers in Maryland."
This is hilarious. They make it seem like this is some sort of intent. We blow this one up, then we blow this one up. There are no other places in the area. So what this guy is saying is, once again, he's going along with these FBI agents, these provocateurs, and that's exactly what they are. They're provoking you. They want a certain response.
As evidence, the government also cites Facebook postings including, "The sword is coming. The reign of oppression is about to cease."
The sword is coming. The reign of oppression is about to cease.
We're likely to see more of these types of cases where the
We're likely to see more of these cases where the FBI infiltrates groups and basically warps your mind to make you want to blow stuff up.
The FBI is trying to get close to individuals who are expressing not only an intent, but a real concrete desire to kill fellows.
Concrete desire. See, he's picking his language. Concrete desire, a tangible example. What he's trying to say here is they're basically going to try to prove to the court, to the jury, that this guy who had absolutely nothing to do with any sort of violence or terror groups, who was just chatting away on the internet, and then the FBI came along and gave him weapons, he was the one who wanted to blow everyone up, and he wanted to blow up an entire center with federal employees and the like.
Today's sting is the latest in a string of successful undercover operations by the government in the last 2 years. Last month, in a carbon copy of this case, 19-year-old Mohammed Osman Mohammed was arrested after his attempt to detonate a fake car bomb supplied to him by FBI agents right before a tree lighting ceremony in Portland, Oregon.
Supplied to him by the FBI.
Others include a 19-year-old Jordanian national arrested after he attempted to blow up this Dallas office tower, and 4 New York men apprehended for plotting to attack a New York synagogue in 2009. Just last week, U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder defended these types of stings.
He is defending entrapment. That's what he's trying to defend here. Take it away, Eric Holder, please. What is your thoughts on this?
We are bound and determined to try to find those people and to try to stop them in whichever way that we can.
Well, sir, they work in the FBI.
And for those who criticize these cases as entrapment, the government says it won't back off because these operations are protecting America.
Oh, it's protecting America. We can entrap people all day long if we want because we're protecting Americans. That's the whole point. And this is the latest slew, the latest case. We've been covering this for 1 year now. From the very beginning, there was a case in my own hometown, North Carolina, where one guy was in a TGI Fridays and talking to a guy. Yeah, I mean, I probably would, you know, if I were to blow up some sort of abortion clinic, I'd do this and that. And the FBI guy was like, yeah, yeah, what else would you do? What else would you blow up? And they basically had him for thought crime, arrested him, put him in jail. All these different terrorist attacks, every single one has had FBI informants there, provocateurs. These people have absolutely no, they're not prone to violence at all. If they would have been prone to violence, they would have blown stuff up. They would have actually done something and not needed the help of FBI agents right there to help them and to help them push the button. Oh, there we are, covering Terror Theater once more on Liberty in Exile. This is CGLO, 1690 AM in Montreal, Quebec. We're right back after these promos. So basically the latest attempt at global governance that we have now is the Cancun Summit. This is the Climate Change Conference. And of course last year it took place in Copenhagen, Denmark, this time December last year. And there was snow on the ground, it was very cold, and they realized, you know guys, we can't make this mistake again of basically making an entire conference that's based on the fact that apparently the globe is getting warmer. We can't set it somewhere where it's freezing cold and it's snowing. So, smart thing to do, bring it to Cancun, Mexico. It's hot, hot, hot. And this is another attempt that we have of basically a huge wealth transfer. And that's the only thing that's ever debated at these Cancun summits, is that every developing country in the world comes up and basically says that, well, our oceans have risen 6 inches in the past 30 years, and the North is to blame. So developed countries, you are to blame. We need money. So they're basically just looking for aid. It's just a redistribution of wealth. We've seen this from the very beginning. It's the same thing. But there is the EU minister who was representing the entire European Union, that's over 500 million people, who made the most telling remarks. This is Connie Hedegaard. I believe she might be from Norway.
From a European perspective, it's very, very important to acknowledge that, yes, negotiators are very important in this process, the experts, the technicians who really know everything. But in the end, it's also about the political will to make the compromises. So that is why it's very important to take care that now we have some very clear text with clear political choices. When you put up targets, long-term
targets,
then you also send a very strong signals to investors. And you give them one of the things that they ask for the most, predictability. And that is why we not only have set up targets for 2020 in Europe, we are actually now in the Commission also preparing what we call a low carbon strategy for 2050, low carbon roadmap for 2050, that will be presented in the spring together with an energy roadmap for 2050 and a white paper on transport, just to say that sort of three major issues will sort of be presented very much in parallel.
So that's the comments there. But her most telling remark doth come in the last 15 seconds.
And I think it would be very worthwhile to try to consider, can't we a bit faster apply standards globally instead of each region making their own standards?
Why should every region make up the decision of what they want to do with their land and their people and their time? Let's make a global initiative. Let's just take a global stance on all of it.
I think, seen from a business perspective, that would definitely also make sense, I guess.
So just because she says the word business, apparently it's supposed to be legitimate. Now, what has been proposed at these climate talks, as it was in Copenhagen, as it was in every single one of them, is we're going to take carbon credits. We're going to take something that we cannot see nor measure correctly, turn it into a commodity, and basically give it to these huge corporations so they can trade and basically continue on the big scam that is carbon offsets and carbon trading. So what you do is say that a certain company is allowed to pollute this much. This is the arguments that go on at these climate summits now. Basically, this company is allowed to pollute this much on this this company is allowed to pollute this much. You have company A and company B. Say company B would like to pollute a little more. All they have to do is go to company A and say, hey, let me buy some of your carbon credits. So then they create this market and they have to change money. And there's people who are behind the scenes betting on where the offsets are going to go. And you're just creating an entire market. That's why, as reported on this show, when carbon offsets and carbon trading cap and trade systems were first put in place in Brazil and places like this, the first companies that were there, Goldman Sachs, Citibank, and JP Morgan. These are the people who trade in this carbon trading. Anything, any climate deal that doesn't have to do actually with reasonable solutions to alternative energy, it's a fallacy. And that's why media organizations like Democracy Now! Sort of see through it. Of course, they're reporting live. We're reporting live from all week from Cancun. And they're reporting on it, and they see these talks of this huge global importance. But all these people are doing is, all right, guys, they get into a room, all these people, 192 countries. All right, guys, what we're going to try to do is we're going to try to tax and sell something that we can't see. Okay? Is that good with everyone? Yeah? Portugal, you're all right? Spain, good? U.S.? All right, good. So we're going to tax this one element that we can't see, and we are a carbon-based life form. We're a carbon-based life form, but we're going to have to basically take it away so everyone is carbon neutral, so nobody is producing anything at all. That's the whole point of the summit right there. Now, if there was some sort of sustainable agreement, hey, I'd all be for it. Sure, no worries. But all this is a global huge transfer of wealth. And the developing countries see that, and they see this as their opportunity. So they come out, they get up on the podium, they talk about how basically their island nation is sinking, how there are more hurricanes and tornadoes, even though what is the causality, my friend, of me driving my Hummer down the street? That has yet to be proved. One important point to make. Now, with them going off about this, and of course these climate arguments going off, they talk a lot about deforestation, about global warming, global climate disruption. Sorry, they changed the name. I did not know. Forgive me. And I have a couple of articles about this. I've been looking at this a lot, and there are a lot of different proposals that come out. One of the more famous ones was Ted Turner's proposal. This is in the Globe and Mail. He basically come out and he says, what we need to do, if we're going to be here, this is quoting from Ted Turner, if we're going to be here as a species 5,000 years from now, we're not going to do it with 7 billion people. So basically what we need to do is limit one child per family for every... This is exactly what's going on. This is what is being told. So basically... a global one-child policy. That's what's needed to save the planet. That's the view that's coming out. And that's what they're trying to push now. That's how it is. And another point of it is that the technology transfer. That's an idea that's been pushed a lot by developing countries, is that they want the technology that a lot of these other countries have. And they'd like to have all of these tech transfers, as they're calling it. This is an article from Reuters here. Technology transfer deal likely in Cancun, but the nitty-gritty is missing. So basically the argument that developing countries are making is that China, India, Brazil, South Africa, India, these are the basic nations, these need to make tech transfers to non-negotiables to other countries. That's basically what they're saying. The United States is included in that, and Canada as well. So they're basically saying that poor nations need more. They need more technology. So why are they using the guise of a warming planet to try this? And it's just another attempt at wealth transfer. They can ask for it. We already give global aid, and it doesn't do anything but breed corruption. We've already tried that from A to B. But the peasant view of the Cancun talks, as says the Guardian this week, is they want to turn air into a commodity. So a lot of false solutions. And that's when people come out and they say, we need climatica justicia. They need climate justice. That's what they're looking for. They believe that they've been wronged. They've been wronged by the developed countries, and they want some sort of reimbursement. Now, there's much more that I can cover about that. And much more information that's available on the internet. And of course, I'll put all the links on libertyinexile.com. They'll be right there on the front page. But of course, we do have to transition here in Liberty in Exile to another important point, because we want to make sure you're safe. We want to make sure you're safe here at Liberty and Exile. We want to make sure you're safe in your homes, at the airport. And also, hey, when you're shopping for food at the Walmart.
Hi, I'm Janet Napolitano, Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security. Homeland Security begins with hometown security.
Now, this is basically an advertisement. There's going to be a telescreen that's at the Walmart checkout. This is not a joke. This is not a joke at all. There's going to be a telescreen at the Walmarts. Sitting right there. They're going to be sitting at the checkout, and there's going to be a message, a video message from Big Sis, Department of Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano. And I also have the story from 4029TV.com, but we'll go ahead and play this. This is at the checkout line when you go to the Walmart. We'll start again so you can hear the whole thing.
Hi, I'm Janet Napolitano, Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security. Homeland Security begins with hometown security. That's why I'm pleased that Walmart is helping to make our communities more safe and secure. If you see something suspicious in the parking lot or in the store, say something immediately. Report suspicious activity to your local police or sheriff. If you need help, ask a Walmart manager for assistance. Thank you for doing your part to help keep our hometowns safe.
So now it's not homeland security, it's hometown security. So if you see something suspicious in the Walmart, almost everyone is suspicious at the Walmart. Anyone walking into those doors past 11:30 p.m. is suspicious at the Walmart. But if you see anybody suspicious, tell a law enforcement officer or a Walmart manager. So when did a Walmart manager have the authority to stop anyone? I don't know. So here's the latest grab of the police state. They're coming into your Walmarts, and they want you to, check on, spy on each other. If you see something, say something. So we're basically turning the nation into East Germany now, into the Stasi, into where everyone is spying on each other and always looking around, very suspicious and paranoid. And this entire thing is just a power grab. That's what it is from the very beginning. And this is a $13 million grant program. This is reading from the article. This is going on especially in Arkansas. It's actually where Walmart started. But over 230 Walmart stores apparently have launched the If You See Something, Say Something campaign. When did this become the chant? When did this become the chant that everyone was hearing? Oh, goodness. Interesting enough, isn't it, at all? So this is the chant that's thrown out now by those who are in power saying, if you do see something in the airport, if you do see something in your Walmart, please tell somebody. And it's gotten to the point of just scaring the living hell out of you and me and everyone else. But as they've been saying, and as Vice President Joe Biden did say weeks ago, the threat is real. Be scared. Continue to be scared, because that's the only way we can justify our trillion-dollar empire abroad, and the only way that we can basically control the West, the rest of the world. That's pushed out. Now, that's just one part of the police state news. Much more going on. There's actually fingerprint scanning going on in Raleigh, North Carolina. Basically, any time that you come into contact with anybody from the public's, basically from the state, they have the right to fingerprint you. That's an article coming from McClatchy. I'm going to put that in the show notes, libertyinexile.com. And many things like that are happening all over the place. And people are starting to realize that. And we do have many themes, and we talk about that from the very beginning on Liberty in Exile, and they're things of importance that we like to cover. Now, our topics today that we started from A to Z, A to Z, as we say in Canada. We started with claimed the interwebs, tax cut frenzy, WikiLeaks, terror theater, climate disruption function, the police state, we mad, the science lifts off, drug war, I hate you, Hollywood hitman, and the nanny state. Of course, there are many stories I could not get to today, as you can tell from the plethora of topics, but I would put all of them on libertyinexile.com. I encourage you to visit the website here today and all week long, as we'll be continuing with our coverage. We'll be continuing with our power grab. We'll be continuing with more and more as we see the elites propped up against the rest of us. Here we are, and we've preached this message on Liberty and Exile for a long time now, and we understand the importance. And we see and we preach alternative media, and we understand the importance of thinking critically and of being the master of your own domain. Use this information lightly. Use it as your will. Think critically. Do your own research. That is why we are here on Liberty in Exile. Join us next week here on CJLO. It shall be our last show producing from CJLO, but our show shall always, forever, be available at libertyinexile.com and on the podcast. I encourage you, all of you out there, have a great week. Au revoir et bonne chance.
Yet the release of this classified information was considered illegal by many, and those who lied us into the Vietnam War and argued for its prolongation were outraged. But the truth gained from the Pentagon Papers revealed that lies were told about the Gulf of Tonkin attack, which perpetuated a sad and tragic episode in our history. Just as with the Vietnam War, the Iraq War was based on lies. We were never threatened by weapons of mass destruction or Al-Qaeda in Iraq, though the attack on Iraq was based on this false information. Any information that challenges the official propaganda for the war in the Middle East is unwelcome by the administration and supporters of these unnecessary wars. Few are interested in understanding the relationship of our foreign policy and our presence in the Middle East to the threat of terrorism. Revealing the real nature and goal of our presence in so many Muslim countries is a threat to our empire, and any revelation of this truth is highly resented by those in charge. Questions to consider. Do the American people deserve to know the truth regarding the ongoing war in Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Yemen? Number two, could a larger question be, how can an Army private gain access to so much secret information? Number three, why is the hostility mostly directed at Assange, the publisher, and not our government's failure to protect classified information? Number four, are we getting our money's worth from the $80 billion per year we spend on intelligence gathering? Number five, which has resulted in the greatest number of deaths? Lying us into war, or WikiLeaks revelations, or the release of the Pentagon Papers? If Assange can be convicted of a crime for publishing information that he did not steal, what does this say about the future of the First Amendment and the independence of the Internet? Number seven, could it be that the real reason for the near universal attacks on WikiLeaks is more about secretly maintaining a seriously flawed foreign policy of empire than it is about national security? Number eight, is there not a huge difference between releasing secret information to help the enemy in the time of declared war, which is treason, and the releasing of information to expose our government lies that promote secret wars, death, and corruption? Number nine, was it not once considered patriotic to stand up to our government when it's wrong? Thomas Jefferson had it right when he advised, "Let the eyes of vigilance never be closed." And I yield back the balance of my time.